We see some of our colleagues now greeting this police state government on Red Square. We have forgotten that rock is a way out. It's a way out of the boundaries of the dull, banal, automatic mechanics of existence.
That was veteran rocker Yuri Shevchuk, frontman for the band DDT, speaking at a concert at Moscow's Olympic Stadium on March 7th, 2010, criticizing his fellow musicians for being too servile, too obedient, and not critical enough of the authorities. And now, let's fast forward to January 2012. What a difference 2 years makes. That, of course, was Pussy Riot, just prior to their current legal troubles, singing Uprising in Russia, the Charisma of Protest. Uprising in Russia, Putin wet his pants. Uprising in Russia, we exist. Uprising in Russia, riot, riot. With three members of Pussy Riot now facing 7 years in prison, Russia's musicians look nothing like the servile lot that Shevchuk criticized back in 2010. A number of establishment musicians have signed a petition in support of the imprisoned women and called for their release. Among them, legendary rocker Boris Grebenshchikov, Mashina Vremya frontman Andrei Makarevich, and Agatha Christie frontman Gleb Samoylov. These are not people who have tended to oppose the Kremlin on much of anything in the past. Makarevich, for example, played at Dmitry Medvedev's inauguration back in 2008. And Samoylov is known to be close to government chief of staff Vladislav Surkov. Russia's musicians are getting more and more politicized. What does it mean? And does it matter? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello, riot, riot.
Riot, riot. Kirill, back in 2010, after his comments at Moscow, at his Olympic Stadium concert in Moscow, the Russian service interviewed Shevchuk. And he suggested in that interview that despite how servile the Russia's musicians appeared to be at the time, there was a bit of a rebellion brewing below the deck. I want to read you a little fragment from that interview. This is what Shevchuk said, starting the quote. I know there are thousands of wonderful musicians who sing songs about civil themes, who do not agree with what's happening in this country. There are a lot of wonderful young people who are playing in cellars. And all this is gaining some critical mass, end quote. So what's happened in the past few years? Have we reached that critical mass that Shevchuk was talking about back then?
If we speak about this process historically, it was going on slowly but steadily, step by step. From the very beginning, there were a lot of, or numerous, those who was against Putin and his regime from the very beginning of 2000s. For instance, this rock band Televisor. And I can name some another names and so on. But mass of Russian rock musicians were either apolitical, mm-hmm. or just maybe sympathizing Putin, and in the very beginning of his first term, or maybe in the end of his first term, because of what? You know, rock music as pop music, yeah, we're speaking, mixing them, yeah, now, mm-hmm. It's a kind of industry. This mm-hmm. industry is based on money. Mm-hmm. And is based on the, you know, on the economical conditions of the audience, mm-hmm. and these conditions improved in the beginning of 2000s during the first and maybe second terms of Putin. And in this sense, there were and still is a lot of money in the industry. Mm-hmm. And don't forget about this. Mm-hmm. Shevchuk was opposing Putin from the very beginning.
But Shevchuk's an institution.
nation unto
himself. Yes, he is not. He is kind of mixture of Russian Bob Dylan and I think Bruce Springsteen.
Mm-hmm.
But for the next generations of rock musicians and groups and pop musicians and groups, the beginning of 2000s was just much better than it was in 1990s. And why
rock the boat?
Yes.
And the ones that were opposed were, as Shevchuk said, playing in cellars, right?
Yeah.
Now they've come out of the cellar.
Yes. This is my first point. Second point is that the next step of this process of divorcing, between Putin and his regime and the pop scene and the rock scene in Russia was Beslan. Mm-hmm. Sure, it was shock. And I know a lot of musicians and those who are around this industry who had been shocked by what happened in Beslan. Sure, it was made
shocked by the authorities.
Yes, not of course, not just because of these terrorists, and
which was shocking itself. Yes, but the authorities
But the attitude of the authorities and their reply to all this was, it was disastrous, just disastrous.
This was when the elections of governors were scrapped. Yes, so you're speaking of this aftermath as well as the
cynicism of using all this strategy in very pragmatic and limited political aims was shocking for some of Russian population and especially Russian intelligentsia. And unlike the situation, social and cultural situation in Western countries where rock musicians or pop artists, they're not part of intellectual circles.
Mm-hmm.
In Russia,
they are very much so.
That's why they are
in the West to a degree.
In some sense, but not not as a rule. But in Russia, as a rule, they are part of intelligentsia or intellectual circles. That's why, by the way, I am always speaking that Russian rock is not real. It's not real.
What do you
rock
mean
music.
It's not real.
No, because rock music, it's not about high ideas. It's not it's not about Derrida or Tolstoy, Tchaikovsky and whatever. It's about energy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's about sex, drugs, rock and roll, whatever. But it has to be sincere.
Mm-hmm.
It's not if you're speaking about such groups or such bands, King Crimson and so on. It's very highbrow and whatever. But usually rock music, it's about Oasis.
Mm-hmm.
Oasis discussing the latest legislation about the elections of governors. It's nonsense.
But I don't think you're going to see the analogy of that in the West either. You'll see political themes pop up, but they're used in allegory, just like in Russian rock.
We have such figures like Bon and so on, but these people, they're also institutions.
Mm.
With all this, sides, political side, economical side, cultural side, or whatever. But as regularly, Western or pop or rock musician, it's just, simple mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not Oasis. Just imagine very sophisticated, Tom York speaking about various details of some political protest. He could be green, very green.
Mm-hmm.
He could fight against whatever racism and so on. But it's not about the ideas. It's about emotions.
Mm.
Rock music, it's about pop music, especially. It's about the emotions. In Russian context, a lot of Russian rock and pop musicians, not pop, but rock musicians, they are very sophisticated people with a very elaborated mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's just, by the way, that's why Russian rock is not about, it's not kind of a real rock music. It's a kind of
I would take issue with that, but I see your point that it's kind of an away. It's a sanctuary away from life rather than something.
Yes, in some sense. That's why I personally I prefer Russian rap to Russian rock.
Well,
music.
I'm glad you mentioned Russian rap because I want to return to this discussion about what happened to Beslan in a minute. Yeah. But for now, I want to listen to a short clip from an artist that listeners of the Power Vertical podcast should definitely be familiar with. Here's Noise MC performing his song "Yes Future," which is on his latest album, and this was during an appearance at Radio Liberty's studio in Moscow back in December.
Слушай мой прогноз человечества. Я в будущее смотрю с оптимизмом. РПЦ совладает с нечистью. У православных отсосут сатанисты. Дьявол признает ошибки прошлого. Папа простит и вернет на небо. Вместо пустого, пошлого, ложного. Правда реальная, как буханка хлеба. Волшебник в голубом вертолете. Давно взлетел и вот-вот прибудет. Ему тут КМ всего пару сотен. Скорее сюда все, кто мечтал о чуде. Ты говоришь, это все невозможно? Нахуй иди, я тебя не спрашивал. Мне от вас, пессимистов, тошно. Все беды из-за нытья ебучего вашего. Миллионы права рульных «Жигулей» заполнят пространство японских хайвеев. Россия впереди планеты всей. No future — это не наша идея. Нам скоро стопудово повезет. Свежий ветер разгонит все черные тучи. Все черти кадилом по морде получат. Yes, future! Yes, yes, future!
Leaving the politics aside, it's no accident that I like to use Noise's music for the intro and the conclusion of this program. That song really shows us the range of the man's talents.
Yes, yes, he's a very good poet, and
Lyrics are intelligent. Yes. They're clever. They're funny, and musically, it's just beautiful.
It's a mixture of hip hop rap and Russian lyrical ballads.
And there's a political subtext to that, even though he says he's not political. He claims to not be political, but there is a political subtext to that.
And it's interesting that he's playing with this punk main punk idea that's no future. Yeah, you remember Sex Pistols, no future for you and me.
But that was not our idea.
Yes.
We want a future.
Yes.
And this is innately political.
Yes, that's why I'm speaking that I prefer Russian rap to Russian, regular rock music and so on. But in some sense, as a part of rock audience, and it's a great secret, a part of Samizdat and underground rock scene in the middle of 1980s, me personally, of course, I remember some bands from the 1980s. Mm-hmm. I was never a great fan of DDT and Yuri Shevchuk. I find them and him very boring. And
I got a soft spot for Yuri Shevchuk, regardless. I mean, I like his music, but I find him so likable.
Yeah, he's a very,
he's so sincere.
Yes,
the guy just oozes sincerity and goodness.
It's a great example of Russian intelligence. Representative of Russian intelligentsia with whom you can sit at the kitchen drinking vodka and discussing everything in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very happy that all this time is they are over.
Now, I want to go back to the point you were making before. What happened after Beslan? Because what happened? It's 2004. Putin's reelected, and now the Putin 2.0 or 1.5 started the move towards centralization, the move towards a more of an authoritarian centralized state began at that time in a lot of ways. What happened at that time in the art world, in the music world?
It was a very long way of disappointment. I just want to remind you that from the very beginning of Putin's era, from the very beginning of 2000, there was a kind of a special cultural policy towards this cultural elite, including rock musicians. Vladislav Surkov, Putin's aide, was in charge of this.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a very close relationships with some the main figures in this area. For instance, with Marat Gelman, who was main figure in Russian contemporary art. And that's why a lot of Russian contemporary artists was not opposed opposing Putin mm-hmm. from the very beginning till the, you know, Medvedev's times.
Right.
Surkov had, and you mentioned this, a very close relationship with this rock band Agatha Christie mm-hmm. and with Gleb Samoylov. Moreover, Surkov wrote lyrics for.
Yes.
And they recorded an album with his lyrics. It's a very decadent idea
yeah.
of, you know, Italian Renaissance Turand.
Right.
So discussing with the humanists all these issues about, you know, Aristotle, Platon, mm-hmm. and so on. So it was funny. It was ridiculous for uh-huh. me. It was ridiculous, but
very effective.
Yes, but in some sense it was very effective. Then you mentioned you have mentioned just Makarevich and Grebenshchikov. Grebenshchikov received a state order mm-hmm. in the very beginning of 2000s. Mm-hmm. It was a great discussion about this, and he told me that he told me, including me, because I interviewed him not in this building, but in the previous building of Radio Free Europe. I interviewed him, asked him about this, and he told me that he's a Buddhist, and that, you know, remember Chinese Empire, there was where nothing happened for, you know, thousands and thousands of years, uh-huh. but Li Bo and other great poets, they just were sitting by the, you know, river and drinking wine and tea and writing lyrics or verses and poems and drawing something mm-hmm. and so on. And Makarevich, who you told that he played on the inauguration and so on. But I think the next turning point was Medvedev's presidency,
mm-hmm.
because Medvedev was a kind of, you know, this there was a kind of game, bad inquisitor,
the good cop.
Investigator cop.
Medvedev played good cop.
Good cop, yes.
Yeah.
And of course, Russian intelligentsia, including all this liberal rockers like, or pop musicians like Makarevich and so on, of course they had some hopes about him, and mm-hmm. That's why they were involved in some events with his participation and so on. But disappointment in the end of Medvedev's era was very bitter and very deep,
mm-hmm.
and that was the next step or next period of this total disappointment.
And I'm going to actually, this is a good point, time to go into our next clip. I want to point out to our listeners that you can't see, unfortunately, this is not a video podcast, but it's Casual Friday here at RFERL, and Kirill is pushing the boundaries of Casual Friday. He's wearing a T-shirt that says "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised." That tells the next band I want to play a clip from is the band called Televizor. So we'll take a little breather and listen to the St. Petersburg-based band Televizor performing the very unsubtle song "Putin is a Fascist." This is an updated version of a hit they had from the 1990s called "Your Father is a Fascist," and they played this at a protest in 2011. That, as I said, is certainly not subtle. And things took on with the musicians a bit of a rougher edge once it was known that the disappointment set in. Putin was coming back. Medvedev was not going to stay for a second term. There was not going to be another great thaw. And I think this song kind of emphasizes the disappointment that people felt at that time. Would you agree?
Barzykin, leader of this band Televizor, he was never disappointed with Putin because he never had any hopes about him.
But Medvedev?
Never, mm-hmm. never. He was absolutely radical. I remember Misha Barzykin from 1987, when mm-hmm. he was just was beginning his career in the Leningradsky Rock Club, rock club, and he was the most radical
of
politically
mm-hmm.
yes artist in this organization. By the way, organized by the
KGB
yeah. to control all this underground rock scene in Leningrad.
Yeah.
But let's return to our times. But a lot of much politically modest artists, they were absolutely disappointed with this trick with turning Putin. And I read a lot of, you know, it's not a time of television, it's a time of Twitter and Facebook, right. And I am just trying to check everything on the social nets about some Russian issues, political and cultural and so on. And I noticed that there were a lot of absolutely angry, disappointed voices from many people whom I know, personally know as a musicians, rock producers, musical producers, you know, managers, rock journalists and so on. That it couldn't be. It couldn't be. Mm-hmm. We don't want him back.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very interesting point. That was an emotional reaction, not intellectual, but emotional. That was maybe the only one point when Russian rock became really rock music, as an emotion, not as a kind of, you know, high idea or something like this. And then began all these protests. Then the next step was the December and January and then February and then Pussy Riot.
Right.
But we told about this and we have to repeat this. Pussy Riot is not a rock band.
No, it's a contemporary art project, and it's actually part of it's an adjunct to Grupa Vojna.
Yes.
Basically,
yes,
and connected by marriage to Grupa Vojna.
Yes, and but I want to focus on one very interesting thing. We are speaking about groups, bands, and musicians in Moscow, St. Petersburg. But don't forget about Russian regions.
I'm
Russian
about
province.
To play one.
Yes,
from not
yes.
Moscow and St. Petersburg.
I know this guy personally. I know this group, band, very, very good from the very beginning of its existence, from 1985, and I know that they were absolutely apolitical for 20 years. For 20. 20 years, more than 20 years. But now they're participating in a famous White Album, this oppositional project, like, you know, Beatles White Album and so on. And this is one of the songs from the project.
Yeah, now this is a band, it's a band from Kirill's hometown of Nizhny Novgorod. The band's called Hronop. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, from Kronos.
Hronop, from Kronos. And this is a band called Hronop, and they're playing a song called Staraya. Let's listen to that song.
А по слухам ее прячут в башне со звездой, ведь была когда-то рыжей и молодой. Растолстела ей вставать лень, так и спит целый день. Мы ее будили стуком разъяренных сердец, что, казалось бы, проснуться должен даже мертвец. И только пересилив страх, она вышла к нам на костылях. В моей стране свобода, в моей стране свобода. Старая баба об одной ноге, старая баба об одной ноге. В моей стране.
It's a song about freedom, isn't it?
Yes, it's a very interesting lyrics, because Stara, it's an old woman, one-legged old woman. It's a Russian type of freedom.
And they're saying freedom isn't a tower with stars, which is an obvious reference to the Kremlin.
Yeah.
Kirill, now the thing about all of this, and this is all well and good, this is happening. The artists have come out of the cellar, so to speak. The musicians have come out of the cellar. And somebody might ask the question, so what? Does this matter? Does this matter in the larger scheme of things? And we were talking about this off mic, I know, yesterday when we were discussing the theme of this podcast, as we often do. And you made some interesting points about the role that pop culture plays for Putin and his ruling circle, his regime, and what this you have some ideas about what this might mean. And I want you to share those with our listeners.
First of all, I have 2 points about this. The first one is about the mechanism of Putin's Medvedev or whatever regime. We discussed a lot such phenomena as a lack of ideology in post-Soviet Russia.
We did a whole segment on it last week.
Yes. But a very interesting aspect of this is that this lack is a real vacuum. And authoritarian regime couldn't be based on a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it will disappear in a second. Mm-hmm. In the first danger, it just destroyed it. Yeah, but the Putin or his aides or whoever they all time they think about how to fill this gap, how to fill this vacuum with what. They have to pronounce some words. It's a very pragmatic regime, but the very pragmatic regime has to pronounce some words about, you know, motherland, about the images of the future of the country and the people and so on, because this is the political sphere. It cannot exist without words. Words are ideology. Ideology is absolutely absent now in Russia. So who could speak all these words about motherland, about patriotism, and pop artists? All this, in Russian, it's estrada, pop scene, full of, you know, full of freak, real freaks, who are absolutely talentless and so on, but it doesn't matter. But they're participating in official or semi-official shows, TV programs and so on. They're participating, for instance, they participated, some of them, had been invited to Putin's inauguration in May. And that was a very interesting situation, because some of them, they brought their smartphones with them and made photos. And one photo, it became viral in the social networks, because it was a photo of three worst Russian pop singers attending Putin's inauguration. You know, it's there is no any you know, similar things in American or, you know, British or French pop culture. It's criminal songs, you know, they're representatives of so-called criminal pop culture. In Russian, it's Russian chanson, but French chanson just
it doesn't exist.
It's a kind of production for actual criminals, former criminals, future criminals, and cops
and presidents.
And cops. They admire all these songs and so on. It's very interesting that because they sing these songs during official concerts for Russian militia or Russian police authorities and so on. It's very interesting. So these people, they are attending Putin's inauguration.
So Putin's based his regime on pop culture, or one of the bases of his. I think it's probably a little bit of a stretch.
He tried to do this.
He tried to use pop culture as a basis. Now, does this rebellion of the musicians have any effect on this?
I think yes, because in the very beginning, all this basement or all this foundation on a pop culture or rock music, maybe in some sense, as a whole, a lot of them defected. From this time. And who left?
The hippest of the hip.
Yeah.
The cool guys left.
Yeah.
And Putin's left with the criminal musicians.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
So this actually is dangerous for the regime.
Yes, this is the first thing. And the second thing, pop music and especially rock music, it's a kind of, concentrated public emotion, by the way. If we are speaking about Christina Aguilera, BNC, in some sense, they focus something in the air. Yeah, something in the public opinion and so on about sex, family, guys. But if they are disappointed, so the disappointment really exists not just in Russian intellectual circles.
But for the whole country.
Yes, but all over the country. So
and,
that is...
And the other point I would add here is that thanks to the internet and social media and advances in technology, they don't need the regime anymore to get their music out there. Yes. They don't need... this is happening all over the world, not just in Russia.
Yes.
It's making the record companies crazy in the West because musicians can just put their stuff out there and bypass all the agents and everything. But in Russia, what it means is they can bypass the Kremlin.
Yes, that's why revolution can't be televised, but it will be tweeted.
Tweeted or podcasted or whatever.
And so on. And we're podcasting now,
And we're podcasting now with you wearing a T-shirt says the revolution will not be televised.
It'll be podcasted,
I'd like to... Actually, this has been one of the more fascinating discussions we've had on this podcast. I'd like to continue it. We got more things to talk about. I'd like to wrap up this discussion about music with a clip of who else but Noise MC. This is Noise doing a freestyle rap in Radio Liberty's Moscow studios back in December.
Свобода – это необходимо, свобода – это нужно, свобода – это наше единственное оружие. Его не существует в реальности, но его нужно было бы придумать для того, чтобы хоть как-то оправдать тот безысходный юмор, который рождается в наших головах, когда некуда идти далее. Спасибо всем, кто это слышит, даже если они в Италии, даже если они далее, если они где-нибудь там на Антарктиде. Слышите меня или нет? Эй, видео!
That was a rap called Svoboda by Noise MC. In a few moments, we'll shift gears and talk about the latest scandal surrounding investigative committee head Alexander Bastrykin, who this week found himself in the news again for all the wrong reasons. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
We have proof now that when Mr. Bastrykin served as first Deputy Prosecutor General of Russia and head of the investigative committee with access to top state secrets, he had a residence permit in the Czech Republic, which is a NATO country.
That was anti-corruption blogger Alexei Navalny talking about the latest scandal surrounding Alexander Bastrykin. It's been just over a month since the last scandal involving investigative committee chairman Alexander Bastrykin. And this week, Russia's top law enforcement official has found himself in hot water again. Back in June, Bastrykin got in trouble over allegations that he had a leading journalist hauled out to the forest and threatened his life. Bastrykin first denied those allegations, but he later apologized for what he called an emotional breakdown. This time, anti-corruption blogger Alexei Navalny has been relentlessly posting and tweeting documents showing that Bastrykin, in violation of Russian law, owned a business in the Czech Republic until 2009. Kirill, I know that your service has been all over this story and has been doing some outstanding reporting on it, so I want to get the ball rolling with you just telling our listeners what this is all about and what your service has learned and what it all means.
I'm not going into the... you know, details.
The minutiae. Let's get the big picture here.
Big picture is that you remember everyone now, everyone remember all this, you know, this golden definition of United Russia political party.
Party of swindlers and thieves.
So all this story, it's about a petty thief.
Mm-hmm.
In Russian context, if you are a grand thief, mm-hmm. Maybe it's not so bad, but the very details of all this situation around Bastrykin, they are very ridiculous. So mm-hmm. I think the most important thing here is the word ridiculous. It's not about luxurious villa somewhere in France mm-hmm. and so on. It's all about a small flat in Panelak,
in Prague. And a business, though.
And
the business is not the flat, not the scandal. The business is the scandal.
But a business is a very small, but I think it's just a fiction. It's not a business.
It's a fictional business.
Yes, because, it's not just to have a kind of... business abroad is against Russian law about state sovereigns and so mm-hmm. on. It's against Russian law to have a kind of residence permit in another country.
A NATO country.
Yes. So, The result is, the outcome of the story is that Bastrykin, during his service as an aide of general prosecutor mm-hmm. Russia, had a residence permit in Czech Republic.
And during his time as head of the investigative committee, if I'm not
mistaken. Yes. This finished in 2009.
Nine, yeah.
Yeah. So I think this is a major violation of Russian law, because all this so-called fictional business, you know Czech law. Mm-hmm. If you want to buy, if
a
you're
flat,
a foreigner,
you have to form a business in order to buy a flat.
And all, I think all of these businesses which are registered in Czech Republic, all of them they're fictional, because people just want to buy some flat here in Prague or in Czech Republic.
Yeah, it's one of the peculiarities of the Czech law. Yeah. My question is, why does Bastrykin need a modest flat in the Czech Republic?
Now, that is
there have been some theories posited about
me,
this.
For me, it's absolute. Psychological enigma. Yeah. It's not about villas. It's not about
No, we're not talking
London,
luxury here.
London apartments and so on. It's a very small, very modest thing. And in this case, he is violating just two points of Russian law. Why did he do this? Stupidity. maybe he was absolutely aware that no one will...
Well, we were discussing this in the newsroom, actually. Yeah. And one of the theories that was posited that's out there is that, remember, Bastrykin became head of the investigative committee in 2007 in the Siloviki War. The battle among the different security services broke out right away, and he was right in the middle of it, right? It was the end of Putin's second term, and people weren't really sure what was going on. And maybe he just wanted to get a place abroad just in case he had to get out of Dodge.
Why,
right?
Czech Republic? But not, why not London, you know, and so on? Because...
Right. It's easy. The language is easier for...
The language is easy. English language is easier.
For you.
Czech, not for me.
The Czech language is a little closer to the Russian language. Is a lot closer to the Russian
people,
language.
Such people, they usually have, aids... translators and so on. So it's an enigma for me. So the most mysterious point is all this situation is very ridiculous. It's all about a very small amount in Russian terms, a very small amount of money, and it's about such a, you know, it looks like a story about head of policeman station in Ust-Kaminogorsk.
Right.
Yeah?
Right.
But not about...
Provincial police chief.
Yes.
Not the top law enforcement in the country.
Yes. And the second thing, for me, it's more interesting, is the rhetoric which had been used by Navalny during his attack.
Well, this is what I want to get to, because in addition to Bastrykin, there's some other agendas at work here. And I want to talk about a couple of these. So let's start with Navalny. This is not a new story.
Yeah.
This story was broken by Hinstein, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Hinstein is not...
a neutral figure. This story was broken back in 2008.
Yeah.
It's not a new story.
Yeah.
But it burst onto the Twitter sphere yesterday like crazy. Now, the justification, because it was like Bastrykin's a foreign agent because of the foreign agent law requiring the NGOs to register as foreign agents. There was all of this funny stuff on Twitter about how Bastrykin is a foreign agent because he owns property in the Czech Republic and therefore is getting money from abroad, apparently. That was just good fun and good PR to get the ball rolling. But this thing lit up Twitter yesterday. It was the top trending thing on Twitter, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Navalny got it going. He's got a lot of followers. Navalny got the ball rolling. There's also, it's no coincidence, I think, today an article appeared in Novoye Vremya, New Times.
About the possibility that
Navalny may be arrested on Monday. What better way to preempt your own arrest than to go after the head of the investigative committee and then make it look... Then your arrest looks utterly political, right?
Yes.
Is there anything to that?
I think, first of all, Navalny's attack, because I followed closely yesterday, so from the very beginning, I noticed Navalny's tweet about something very important is forthcoming. I began to follow everything from this point. But first of all, Navalny's attack was very, very, very well prepared.
Yes.
And the form, the very form and the logic of the form, how these documents had been, you know, written and constructed, mm-hmm. and all with provided with all the links to various official Czech institutions and register mm-hmm. office and so on. So
he made some mistakes in Czech translations a couple times, but he was corrected very quickly.
Yes, yes. My colleague Sasha Wagner corrected him because she knows Czech language. Mm-hmm. Very well. This attack was very, very, very well prepared once more.
And so, Hinstein was relentless in giving Navalny an assist here.
Yes. That's why I'm not a supporter of conspiracy ideas and so on. But I think that this is a part of a very big game.
I think that you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to think that. I think that's very obvious. Somebody's after Bastrykin.
Yes.
Because let's look. The scandal back in June about when he threatened the Nova Gazeta journalist in the woods.
Very dubious story. Yeah.
Mr. Hinstein was who's today's Twitter tag is Pan Bastrykin. He put a hashtag out there called Pan Bastrykin, which in Czech means Mr. Bastrykin. He was instrumental in getting promoting that scandal as well. Nova Gazeta was, of course, the first, but Hinstein just wouldn't let it drop, and he was talking about it in the Duma.
Yeah.
And for anybody that doesn't know, Mr. Hinstein is a former investigative journalist and a quite good one, who is now a deputy with United Russia. But he's had it. He's been going after Bastrykin, and my question is, why? He's been involved in both of these scandals now.
I don't know who's supporting or who's using Hinstein as a tool in the struggle. But everyone is speaking about a long fight between the General Office of General Prosecutor and this investigative committee between Chaika and Bastrykin.
Do you think Chaika's got the strength to go after
Bastrykin? I'm not sure. I'm not very experienced in criminology, and I don't want to be. but I think that someone is supporting Chaika in this case.
Someone's behind Chaika.
Behind Chaika, I think maybe someone who is opposing Sechin, who is behind.
Well, this is what it gets all down to. I mean, let's play criminology for a minute because we kind of have to. Okay, Bastrykin, Putin's law school classmate, very close to Igor Sechin. That he's with the group of the heavyweight Siliviki. Okay, Bastrykin is with that. On the other hand, you have Chaika, who's an ally of whom? Medvedev.
No. Medvedev doesn't exist anymore.
Well, no, I mean, Medvedev doesn't exist anymore. But, I mean, who is with Chaika? I mean, Chaika is closer to the technocratic wing of the elite, as it is.
Yes, in the politologist terms, yes. But maybe, I just can suppose that there is some kind of struggle inside Siloviki. Mm-hmm. I think maybe this way, because someone...
But who are the other Siloviki? This is what's driving... And we got to get Mark Galeotti on the podcast to talk about this.
It's not politics, it's a psychology. We don't know, because it couldn't be just, personal dislike between Sechin, some Mr. X, and so on, or some unknown details about their influence on Putin or Putin's influence on them, and so on. I think it's not terribly interesting. That's why I'm speaking about criminology very cautiously. Sometimes struggle happened inside, without any other connections, but inside Hitler's circle, inside circle, or Peron's, or Franco's, or whoever. Mm-hmm. So this is psychology. It's not politics. We can't explain and define the struggle in political terms. This is just people who are struggling with each other, fighting with each other.
I think it's something bigger than that. I think I don't think this is just a little battle among the Siloviki over, who gets what. Like the Siloviki War of 2007 was, for example, that Bastrykin was also involved in. This is happening at a time when there is a debate in society and in the elite about Russia's future direction. Bastrykin is on one side of that struggle, right? The other side, it's not Siloviki on the other side, or at least not big leading Siloviki on the other side. But on the other side are, and yes, Medvedev, okay, is nobody, but there are other people on the other side are people like Medvedev. Surkov, for example, is on the other side. Surkov wanted things to go in a different direction. He didn't favor Putin's return. We know that now. You know, so they're the what we would call the technocratic wing of the elite, what I would call the managers. Against the shareholders, again, to go back to some of the dichotomies we've used in this podcast and that I've used on the blog in the past. But I'm not sure where it's coming from, but I'm pretty sure it's coming from that side of the elite. In an interview with Your Service, the political analyst Vladimir Pribilovsky made this point as well today in an interview with the Russian service, where he said it's coming from this. It's Sechin and the Medvedev side of the elite. It's not Medvedev personally, but what we used to consider the Medvedev side of the elite. Medvedev isn't quiet and invisible right now, but there's something larger going on here. How this is resolved is going to tell us a lot. Actually,
I don't know, because no one knows, because it depends on various things. First of all, we don't know everything is about. I'm not sure that Bastrykin or who else, you know, Sechin has any clear point of view about Russia's future. I am absolutely sure
he wants the status quo. He wants to go back to 2000. Quo. He wants to party like it's 2007.
Yes, it's not about future. It's about a political technology. It's about the machine.
He wants to continue collecting energy rents. He wants to continue running the energy sector. He doesn't want the energy industry privatized. And if it's privatized, he wants to privatize on his terms, where he's going to benefit from it. That's what Mr. Sechin and that part of the elite. All about. They want to go back to 2007. They want to pretend the Medvedev presidency never happened, and they can just go back as if Putin's third term was starting in March 2008, and not March 2012.
Let's put it in other words. I think we can discuss a struggle, or maybe a kind of a furious discussion between two sides or two teams inside Kremlin. Those who feel a forthcoming disaster, and those who don't feel the forthcoming disaster. Mm-hmm. Those who don't feel this disaster, the beginning or starting or launching or whatever, they want this status quo.
Right.
Those who understand that everything can change in just in 3 days.
That things have changed, not can change, but have changed.
In a very serious sense, in economic terms and social terms and so on, till, you know, the limits of uprising and so on. So those people, of course, they can oppose... presumably, can oppose these supporters of status quo.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that this is a distinction between so-called conservatives and so-called liberals. Just let's return to the beginning of 1980s, when there were two similar parties inside Kremlin, inside
KGB Politburo. And the party.
KGB was those who were... KGB was the body who supported the idea of reforms, because they knew everything about the society and the forthcoming disaster.
Right.
And those who opposed, those who was for supporting status quo, was not just some conservatives or Siloviki and so on. They were just bureaucrats. Yeah. From CPSU.
All right, well,
let's
transpose that onto today. And I'm going to bring up Mark Galeotti again, because he's made this point several times in our discussions on the podcast and in discussions outside of the podcast, that there are many people inside the security services that do want change, that are not really comfortable with things are going. The division right now may be the lower levels of the security services and the higher and the people, the people we call the Siloviki, your Bastrykins and Sechins and Patrushevs and Ivanovs, and the other generation. There's another generation below the decks, and maybe they're the ones that are, I don't know. And this is why, Mark, if you're listening, I think I'm going to give you a call and ask you to come on the podcast next week. because this is an interesting theme. And if this is the case, this is very interesting. I don't know where this is coming from.
It's very interesting how we moved from the political terms to philosophical terms. Now we are discussing the problem of knowledge. Those who have this knowledge about a real situation in country and those who don't want to have this knowledge. Mm-hmm. This is the division, the real real division. Right. And the problem of knowledge in modern world is a problem of technology. Mm-hmm. And we're returning to our previous, one of the previous podcasts about the isolation of Putin and his... Mm-hmm. From reality. But reality today is not television, but Twitter, Facebook, social networking, and all this internet thing. And that is, I think, the real division. It's a philosophical question of knowledge and a will to have this knowledge.
I mean, all leaders are isolated to a degree.
In
some sense. And so part of it is this, that, yeah, these guys aren't the most kind of social media savvy people in the world. But part of it, I think, is willful ignorance. They don't want to see this.
Yes, they don't want to see this. That's what I'm speaking about.
They want to go back to 2007.
Not in Nietzschean terms, but it's about, Schopenhauer terms, but it's about a will to have a knowledge to obtain this.
Well, I think this is a discussion we'll be continuing in future podcasts.
With some professors of philosophy, yeah.
I'm going to be giving you a call this week. That's unfortunately all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you that you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can also read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.